Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is David E. Fishman, a professor of Jewish history at the Jewish Theological Seminary, where he specializes in modern Jewish history. He has also taught at Brandeis University, Bar-Ilan University, Russian State University in Moscow, and Yeshiva University's Bernard Revel Graduate School of Jewish Studies. He has also held research fellow positions at the Hebrew University's Institute for Advanced Studies and the University of Pennsylvania's Katz Center for Advanced Judaic Studies. Dr. Fishman is the author of numerous books and articles on the history and culture of East European Jewry. The books include Russia's First Modern Jews, The Rise of Modern Yiddish Culture, and most recently, The Book Smugglers, Partisans, Poets, and the Race to Save Jewish Treasures from the Nazis, which has been hailed as a Monuments Men for Book Lovers and first-rate scholarship that pulses with the beat of a most human heart. That book and some recent discoveries of documents will be the topic of today's discussion. In addition to those monographs, David has also co-edited a volume with Burton Visovsky entitled From Mesopotamia to Modernity, 10 Introductions to Jewish History and Literature, and solo edited another volume on Yiddish writings with a title that I'm not even going to try to pronounce. Perhaps we can get Dr. Fishman to pronounce it later for us. In earlier days, Dr. Fishman was editor of Yivo Blader, the Yiddish language scholarly journal of the Yivo Institute for Jewish Research, and is currently a member of the academic committee of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. This is just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to his scholarly credentials, and we will point you over to his website to get more information about this prolific scholar. Check that out over at our website, and don't forget to join us over at Facebook and on Twitter. David, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. It's a pleasure to be here.
I noted in the introduction that you edited a book on the writings of a rabbi whose name that I can't pronounce, nor can I pronounce the actual title of the book. So I'm going to give you the chance to give a shout out for that book and also ask for your forgiveness in any Eastern European or Yiddish names that I try to pronounce today.
Sure, Tony. Totally understood. The rabbi is Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. He was a great 20th century Orthodox Jewish thinker, and this is a collection of his sermons in Yiddish, from Yiddish manuscripts, which in Yiddish is called Droshes und Ksovim. That's very hard, which is really simply sermons and other writings.
Yeah, I was reading through your book here, The Book Smugglers, and I do have a little bit of Polish ancestry, so there was a lot of Polish names that came up, but I have to admit, not having been kept up on my Polish since I never actually studied it, so the words, I was stumbling over them in my mind, but it sounds like you got a good handle on how to pronounce all these things, so that's good. Now, you grew up in New York, and you became interested in East European Jewish history. Tell us about that journey. How did you get from being a kid in New York to studying this stuff now?
I grew up in the Bronx, more specifically, and it was a very Jewish neighborhood, but also Irish and Italian. It was a mixed, in a very ethnic neighborhood, and I guess from my childhood on, I was fascinated by the old folks. And the old folks, the old Jewish folks in my neighborhood, they were all immigrants or refugees from Eastern Europe, all Yiddish speakers. And I had a close relationship with my grandfathers. So I think really my interest in this, in that part of the world, derives from my grandparents and from the old folks in the neighborhood.
So you get that interest there, and then you're off to college. Where'd you go to college, and how did you get hooked up with a graduate degree in Jewish history?
college, I went to Yeshiva University in New York. Then graduate school, I went to Harvard. Harvard had a great program, still probably has a great program in Jewish history and civilization. And there are many good academic graduate programs out there. That was more about getting, you know, method and discipline and reading a lot. But the passion and the interest were way before my, you know, my academic studies.
Very cool. Now, your recent book, The Book Smugglers, and we'll link to that on our website, talks about the heroic efforts of a group that became known as the Paper Brigade of Vilna. And Vilna, which is now Vilnius, is a city in Lithuania. Now, before we get into this tale of how large amounts of books and other documents were saved from Nazi and Soviet pillaging, tell us a little bit about the Jewish community in the Baltics, and particularly Vilna. Most folks, including myself, would probably think of Lithuania as being a Catholic stronghold. So how does this Jewish community get into the territory, and what are the demographics of this community?
Jews go back to living in Lithuania since the Middle Ages, at least since the 1300s. Of course, back in the Middle Ages, Poland and Lithuania were a two-part state, Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. Vilna emerges as an important center in the 1500s. I mean, so we're talking about really old history of many centuries of uninterrupted Jewish presence and residence. Yes, in a very strongly Catholic milieu, just like Poland. Now, the demographic, even before demographics, and it becomes so important, this community, Vilna, Vilnius, that it gets the nickname the Jerusalem of Lithuania, or the Jerusalem of the North. It was such an important center of Jewish learning and publishing and study of rabbinic academies that it gets that rather unusual nickname. As for demographics, you asked about demographics, it becomes a heavily Jewish city. In the Russian census of 1897, 40% of the inhabitants of the city were Jewish. Now, that goes down in the 20th century, so on the eve of World War II, it's something like 29%, but that's still a very high proportion, at least for our American ears, you know, where New York, which is considered the most Jewish city in America, you know, it's probably 15% Jewish, right, the five boroughs. So that's, in a nutshell, Lithuania and Vilna in Jewish history.
You mentioned that from about 1897 to, let's say, 1930s, late 1930s, the population drops from 40% to 29%. Is that an effect of people leaving, or is it more people, more Catholics kind of flooding in and watering down the population?
A little bit of both, actually. It's more the growth of the Catholic population, but this is one of the paradoxes of this community is, in general, this is not an economically flourishing place, Vilna, between the World War I and World War II. But it remains intellectually, very vibrant and important place. I often tell my students, you know, compare it to Oxford, England. You know, in other words, not big numbers, not tremendous wealth or economic activity, but intellectually and spiritually, you know, a very important center.
Now, until I read your book, I had never heard the term Jerusalem of Lithuania. And I know today Lithuania is a small country. It was much bigger, and kind of it grows and expands throughout history, depending on the territorial lines that are being drawn. But how does Vilna compare in terms of its Jewish demography relative to other places in Eastern Europe? Is it one of the most densely populated Jewish cities, or is it similar to other places that you might find in, you know, Warsaw or in Germany or other places like that?
Well, if we stick to Eastern Europe, you know, Poland, Russia, and every country in between, this was quite typical before World War II. About a third of the population of Warsaw was Jewish. other big Polish cities, if you look at Lwów or Łódź, similarly, you'll see usually about a third. And also in big cities like in Ukraine, like Odessa. We don't think of these places that way because of the Holocaust. You know, there haven't been large Jewish populations there, you know, for the last 75 years. But the pre-war reality was such of the big cities were Polish-Jewish or Ukrainian-Jewish.
So all this gets up some interesting histories here. You're a historian, and the tale that you tell is one that takes us back roughly 8 decades to the 1930s or so. But I want to start in the present. The reason I discovered you and your book as a guest for the show is because there was a recent article in the Smithsonian Magazine about a discovery of roughly 170,000, I'm going to repeat that number, 170,000 Jewish books and manuscripts in Vilnius that were thought to have been destroyed. And that's a big cache there. I don't know where one would, you know, put all that stuff. It'd be a large closet, I think. And that those 170,000 documents, too, add to the cache that you write about in your book, The Book Smugglers, which was about 150,000. So the question for you, how did this recent discovery of 170,000 documents come about, and how does one misplace all those documents? I mean, that's just, somebody has to have found them over 75 years.
Wow. That's a tall order. I don't know which stage of the story to jump in. First, I'll correct, not really you, but Smithsonian Magazine. It's, to make it more realistic, it's 170,000 pages of documents,
okay.
Not 170,000 books and documents. That would, but I think I'll jump in the middle here, which is under the Soviets, in other words, from 1949, the last years of Joseph Stalin's rule, this material was held in a Lithuanian book chamber, was what it was called, a book repository. But the director, a Lithuanian, was aware that the Soviet Union was intensely anti-Semitic then, and that he was actually taking a risk. He was actually endangering himself and his institution by holding on to this Jewish, these Jewish books and papers, and he received orders to destroy them. So he actually hid these materials inside his own book repository. And the main way he did it, he had mountains and mountains of books, unprocessed, uncatalogued, Lithuanian and Polish and Russian and other books. And he hid the Jewish material at the bottom of the mountains, underneath the mountains, and it lay there for decades. In fact, it was really only began to be processed, that is, you know, catalogued, organized, when the Soviet Union fell in the late 1980s and early 1990s. So that's when we got the first cache that was discovered, you know, at the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union. Now, I should explain, to get to this recent discovery, that this book repository is located in a former church and monastery. Of course, the Soviets, being quite anti-religious in general, converted the church, St. George's Church, and the monastery into a national book repository. So it's a large complex of buildings and rooms and closets and attics. Hard to get your hands on all of the territory. And some of the material, this latest cache, was only discovered recently because the book chamber, the book repository, had to move because the decision had been made to return the monastery and the church to the church, as it should be. And once they had to vacate the entire complex, they found lots of things they didn't even know they had, including this latest cache of Jewish material.
So just in the process of moving it, these weren't hidden in some secret closets or behind walls or anything like that. It was just on the bottom of a mountain of books, and somebody just started picking them off at the top and say, okay, we got to move these. And all of a sudden, when you get down to the bottom, there's like, this looks like Hebrew writing. What's this doing here? And then they report it to somebody?
That's exactly it.
Wow. Now, with these 170,000 pages, that's different than documents. So I'm glad that you corrected me on that, because I was thinking, wow, this got to be a mound. If you figure the average book is maybe 100 to 200 pages, and some of these are probably short pamphlets and things like that. Do we have any good sense of what the composition of this most recent find is? We'll talk about some of the things that you write about in your book, but I mean, what are we talking about here? Theological books? Are we talking just about recipes that people have, or maybe bookkeeping entries for local synagogues? What's in this document mix?
It is a tremendous mix. I almost could just say all of the above and more. In other words, you have got theological writing, mystical writing, legal or Jewish law, writings on Jewish law, sermons. We've definitely got a lot of that type of material there. But you've also got poetry, literary manuscripts. You've got historical testimony, for instance, of pogroms in Russia, handwritten recounts of what survivors of pogroms remember, autobiographies. I should explain that the material is not, we know where it came from. It comes from three main repositories, Jewish repositories in Vilna before the war, a research institute, a library, and a museum, right? These are, and so therefore, it's not stray papers, somebody's groceries list these are, really valuable collections collected by, important institutions before the war.
Okay. I was curious about this, too, because I know, scholars love the important theological writings and the poetry and that, but I'm oftentimes fascinated about the things like grocery lists, too. I've looked at some of these in my studies of Latin America, and you pick up some of these documents, and it's just somebody's, this is what we're going to be doing during this holiday, and this is what we need, and just holding that in your hand, it just kind of takes you back to the daily life of people, and that always gives me a little tingle up my spine just to be transported in history that way.
Let me share, one document that I was really stunned by, that moved me, that does capture something of everyday life, and it's old. It's from the mid-19th century, from the 1850s.
Mm-hmm.
And what it is a contract between the Association of Jewish Water Carriers in Vilna. Let me explain that, right? There's no running water. There's no, sewage system in the 1850s. So you've got wells, and you've got professional water carriers that, carry buckets of water to people's homes. That's what they do for a living. And they have had a guild, the Association of Jewish Water Carriers of Vilna. As you can imagine, these are very poor and simple folk, right? And they make a contract with the local yeshiva, or, rabbinic academy, contract between the, top elite and the simplest, lower class. And what's the deal? What's the contract? The water carriers want to have their own religious services on the Sabbath, but they don't have a room. They don't have a space. So they agreed, the academy agrees to give them a room for their own prayer services. And in exchange, the water carriers promise to donate whatever Hebrew books they have, religious books, set up a Talmud, set up a Bible, to the academy. And that's the deal. That's the deal. The water carriers give their books. The academy lends them a room, rent free. And that opened up a whole world to me of Jewish life in Vilna in the 1800s.
I do. That is it seems like such a simple story, but it's so fascinating because we don't even think of having people to bring buckets of water to our doorstep every day. We just turn on the tap. And so now you kind of get a sense for what life was like back in the 19th century in these daily things. Somebody has to get up. You know, even the smartest of rabbis who's thinking brilliant thoughts has to make sure that the bucket of water is there for everybody in the morning.
And even the water carrier wants to pray.
Yeah, exactly.
Wants to have their own religious prayer service. That matters to them.
Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely fascinating stuff. Speaking of history, you just transported us back about 200 years. But let's go ahead and drop back to the 1930s up to maybe 1940, 41, and talk about why the documents that you write about in the book Smugglers go missing, as well as the ones that were recently discovered. Start us off by setting the table and telling us the context of Lithuania, maybe Poland, East Europe, a little bit more generally here.
The Nazis get to that part of Eastern Europe, to Vilna, to Vilnius, later. They only get there in June 1941, when between 1939 and 41, this part of this region is conquered by the Soviets, and the Soviets actually annex Lithuania and make it part of the Soviet Union in June 1940. So there are all kinds of travails in that sort of transitional period. Actually, Jews, given the choice of either being under Nazi domination or Soviet domination, tend to flee the Nazi, if they can, fled Nazi-dominated territory to get into Soviet-dominated territory. So you actually get a rise, a growth of the Jewish population between 39 and 41, whoever can flee the other parts of Poland that are under the Nazis. So that's a transitional period. It's a complicated one, but the worst of times come when the Germans come, when the Nazis come, after June 1941, and pretty quickly you're getting mass roundups of Jews on the streets, and they're being sent to an execution site just on the outskirts of town, where they're mowed down by machine gun into a pit, and a ghetto is created, in other words, a restricted 7 blocks with a wall around it where Jews have to live. And those first 6 months of the Germans' occupation are the most traumatic. The Jewish population of Vilna in 6 months goes down from about 70,000 to about 20,000. In other words, more than two-thirds of the Jews of the city are murdered in a six-month period of time. Then, in January 1941, 1942, the mass murder stops, and the ghetto enters what's known as a period of stability. Life is very hard, and there are all kinds of terrible things that happen, but this kind of systematic, mass-scale murder is put on hold for the next year and a half. That's the ghetto in Vilna will be what they called liquidated, meaning dissolved, and all its remaining inhabitants sent to different places, either to labor camps or to death camps. That will happen in September 1943. After September 1943, you know, there are no Jews in Vilna.
What is going on with respect to the destruction of books? Because this isn't just a rounding up of individuals into a ghetto and the murder of them, but it's also an attack on cultural history. And this is the important part that you tell that I think you know, broadens the scope of the Holocaust and make you kind of understand it's not just people, it's an entire culture that is under siege. So how does this process of starting to destroy books start to occur? And who is this guy, Johannes Pohl, who becomes the, I guess, director of the destruction of Jewish literature?
Well, the history of Nazi book burning is, you know, it predates the war. In other words, one of the first big public events the Nazis did when they came to power in Germany was a public burning of books by Jewish authors and other enemy authors. It takes on a different character during the war, and because the Germans decide they want to have the greatest library on earth, and including the greatest Judaica library on earth, and therefore they've decided. I'll explain that in a minute, but I want to. So they actually decide that there are going to be two things here going on: looting and destruction. Looting of whatever they want to have for their great library in Germany, and destruction for everything else. And that's the segregation process. Why do the Nazis want to have the greatest Judaica library on earth? Because, as heirs to the great German tradition of scholarship and science, they want to develop a field of anti-Semitic Jewish studies. They call it Judenforschung, study of the Jews. And this field will show in scholarly, academic terms just how evil the Jews are, how depraved they are, how harmful they are. In other words, the scholarship will justify the policies of genocide that the state is pursuing. But in order to do that properly, they need the raw material, the primary sources. They need Jewish books. They need documents, manuscripts, so that anti-Semitic Nazi scholars will be able to study them. All the rest is considered, you know, enemy literature, harmful literature. It must all be sent to incinerators or what they call paper mills that basically repulp old paper into new paper. Now, the fellow you asked about, Johannes Paul, he is one of the top people in this field of anti-Semitic Jewish studies, of Judenforschung. His biography is rather peculiar. Originally, he's an ordained Catholic priest, and he gets advanced studies in Rome and advanced studies in Jerusalem. Between 1932 and 1934, he's at a pontifical institute in Jerusalem. And he acquires biblical Hebrew and even modern Hebrew, and according to some reports, even took courses at the Hebrew University, the main Jewish and Zionist educational institution in Jerusalem. Then in 1934, and the Nazis are in power by then, he comes back to Germany, resigns from the priesthood, gets married, and does it, you know, basically flips from being a devout Catholic to being a devout Nazi, and he becomes one of the top Judaica librarians in Nazi Germany, and eventually becomes the librarian for the what was called the Institute for the Study of the Jewish Question, and he becomes the top Judaica book looter for all of Europe. Vilna is a very important place on his itinerary, but he is doing similar looting and destruction in all cities of Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. I was able to follow his journeys. You know, he is in Kovno, today Kaunas, Lithuania, in Riga, in Latvia. He's in Minsk, in Belarus, in Kiev, and Kharkov, in Ukraine. He even gets to Salonika in Greece, and everywhere it's the same kind of project, which is looting apart and destroying the rest.
Yeah, it's amazing to be thinking about this, and you know, when we hear stories of World War II and see the movies, read the books, and like we think about all the fighting and that, but there's so much other things going on, and as I mentioned before, this is not just an attack on people, it's an attack on an entire culture and a way of life, going after historical documents that really is just incredibly destructive. When you think about the scope of this thing, one of the places that was looted and becomes important in your book is something known as YIVO, the Yiddish Scientific Institute, and you've had connections with it in contemporary times. So give us a brief background of what that is.
YIVO was founded in Vilna in 1925, basically as a modern academic institution, not a religious one, but to study mainly modern Jewish history, Yiddish language and literature, Jewish folklore. There were no Jewish studies in universities back then, definitely not in Polish universities. So the only place where Jews could pursue such studies were by creating their own academies. And it developed before the war a wonderful library, but even more important, a fantastic archive. And it sent, because it appealed to simple people again, saying, if you have any documents or literature, don't throw it out, send it to us. And people sent them, let's say synagogue newsletters, local newspapers, and all the kind of stuff you throw out, posters for theater performances, and organizations also donated their records, which they might have sent, thrown out instead of. And so in the course of time, this institute acquired a truly extraordinary archive on Jewish life in Eastern Europe. Quite luckily, the director of this institute was not in Poland, not in Vilna, in September 1939, when the war began. He was at a conference in Denmark. And instead of returning to war-torn Poland, he left for the United States. He got an immigration visa to the United States and rebuilt YIVO in New York. So since 1940, the headquarters of YIVO has been in New York, even though it was founded in Vilna in 1925.
It's one of those interesting fortuitous stories where, you know, history, you know, takes a specific turn, and you understand that there's probably the guiding hand of the divine in here, making sure that this stuff gets to safe places. So, a fascinating story. The really interesting and fascinating story in the meat of your book, The Books Smugglers, is how the Lithuanian community, the Lithuanian Jewish community, goes into action once they understand that these documents are starting to be rounded up. Tell us the story of, I'm going to try to pronounce the name here, Shmurka Kazarzynski. Is that pretty good?
Pretty good.
Okay. And what becomes known as the Paper Brigade. What is going on here in the first year or two? You remember that people are being murdered all over the place. They're being rounded up into these ghettos, very concentrated seven-block ghettos. But people still say, hey, we got to save these documents. What's going on?
It is a truly fantastic story. Johannes Paul, decides that he needs to hire Jewish slave laborers to process all these books and documents and manuscripts, you know, to segregate what goes to Germany, what goes to the paper mills for destruction. To make that segregation, you have to know the languages, you have to know the history. So he creates this group of Jewish slave laborers, all of them intellectuals, in other words, scholars, educators, writers, musicians and artists, and they work for the Germans, so to speak. And Shmerke Kaczerginski, I just call him Shmerke in the book because I know Kaczerginski is a very hard name to pronounce. He's one of them. Shmerke is a poet, and he's the group decides they must smuggle the material. They can't bear to see it being destroyed, and they can't bear to see it being deported to an anti-Semitic institute in Germany. So now smuggling it, hiding it, involves, first of all, in those finding moments when the Germans aren't in the room or in the building, and usually it means hiding books and documents literally on your body, underneath your clothing, taking it out of the work site. The work site where they worked was outside the ghetto, and then you have to smuggle the material back into the ghetto, past guards at the gate, and once inside the ghetto, you know, bury it somewhere. So this paper brigade is engaged in this smuggling activity for 18 months, from February 1942 to August 1943. And it's all about, as you said, rescuing a culture. And it's all about dignity also, mm-hmm. that the destruction of a culture is as great a crime as the destruction of a people. And they're very committed to this enterprise. There are ghetto inmates who really criticize them and say, you're crazy. In this time, we should all be smuggling potatoes or food into the ghetto. Why are you wasting your time on books and papers? But they are respond that culture is important, and the mind and the spirit matter, and that this material will be needed by posterity, and they commit themselves to this book smuggling enterprise.
Yeah, I want to emphasize that point, because as I was reading through your book, and you're just saying there's critics of this saying you should be smuggling in potatoes. We even see this in the modern era when the Taliban were destroying Buddhist statues in Afghanistan. The ISIS has gone through and destroyed a bunch of Assyrian relics and stone carvings and all this, and a lot of people are upset. They're saying, you know, they're also killing lots and lots of people. We should be really focused on that. Primarily, why is everybody getting so upset about these stone statues? But you know, when you come and think about it, and like your thoughts on this, that when you destroy these documents, these artistic representations, it is just trying to obliterate the memory of people off the face of the earth, which is just... When you think about it deeply, it's even more destructive than killing an individual human being, which is atrocious to begin with. But just to erase the memory of an entire people is just horrendous.
I couldn't agree more. In other words, it's actually two stages. I'm just paraphrasing you of the same activity. You will wipe the people off the face of the earth, whether it's a religious group or an ethnic group, and you will even wipe out their memory so that no one will be able to know much about them, because the books, the papers, or for that matter, you know, the monuments, the churches will have been obliterated, so that there will not even be the memory of this group's existence.
Yeah. So what they're doing is just absolutely incredible. And the book, I should mention to our listeners, is an incredible read. It's an academic book, but it's one that reads somewhat like a biography and a story that just you can put yourself in the moment and these individuals, the pressure that they must come under. Because at various points while reading through the book, I just put myself in the place of this. You mentioned these... you know, Shmurka and others are putting these things on their body, and then they have to walk past guards. And I'm just thinking, what's going through their mind at the moment? What happens if they get caught? If somebody does get caught, how does that affect them for the next few weeks or so? Do they roll back? Tell us a little bit about just that whole process of and kind of fill it out with vivid details of how these people are smuggling this thing. Do some people get caught? What happens?
Mm-hmm. Yes, those are the greatest moments of tension at the ghetto gate, when the guards are going to inspect them. And in part, it all depends on who is at the gate, who is inspecting. Is it Lithuanian police? Is it the Jewish ghetto police? Because there was a Jewish police for inside the ghetto. Or is it Nazi Germans? Of course, if it's Germans, then the inspections are very strict, very tight, and the consequences are fatal, actually. Anybody caught smuggling even a potato when Germans are inspecting, will be sent to their death. If it all depends on the mood of the German official also. In other words, at the very least, they'll get 25 lashes. It was a special little booth next to the gate to the ghetto where they take people in and beat them for the crime of smuggling in food. So there are many tense and amazing moments of, in the book. Maybe I'll just pick one or two. One of them is one of the poets has a gets a permit from his boss, from Paul, saying he'd like to take in scrap paper for his oven, to heat his oven in the ghetto. And Paul signs a piece of paper. Sure, you can take in, it's trash, trash paper, garbage, so that you can, you know, not freeze in the ghetto. And then the poet, you know, this trash paper that he crumples up and takes in past the gate is, you know, all kinds of manuscripts. I should point out not only Jewish ones, but also because this worksite also collects, it expands in its function, not only Jewish material, but also Russian material and even Polish material. So he's taking in manuscripts by the great Russian writers, you know, Tolstoy and Gorky, and he's taking in, of course, by Yiddish writers, and all of this he says a drawing by Marc Chagall, the great artist, and all of this he simply shows his paper to the Nazi guard at the gate and said, "This is my trash paper," and the German lets him in. So there are, I'll tell one other, you know, one of the women who worked in the brigade, because there were women, not only men, she brought in a silver cup for wine cup used in the Sabbath service, you know, as a sort of for the blessing of wine. And she tried to sneak that in to the ghetto. The German finds it on her body. She then takes it out and says, "Oh, I brought this for you. It's a present." And she also gives a nice pair of gloves to the German. And the German apparently accepted the bribe and said, "Okay," and let her through. And everyone's amazed. Everyone is shocked. They were sure she was going to be sent to her death. So there is a lot of risk-taking and a lot of luck that these people had to survive that moment.
And you mentioned that a number of, in the book, a number of the people do get caught and are summarily executed, which is...
Well, the vast majority of the people involved in this paper brigade, you know, perished.
Mm.
It's not that they were caught literally with these papers on their hands, but... you know, either at the time of the liquidation, the dissolving of the ghetto, or even earlier. So of the 40 people who worked in that brigade, 34 perished and 6 survived.
Yes. Now, let's fast forward here a little bit. In July 1944, Vilna is liberated. It's liberated by the Soviet Union, not by the U.S. or the Allies. There must have been some relief to all of this, but it's also a recognition that the Soviets are themselves not all that religious friendly. So what occurs at the period of the liberation and shortly thereafter?
Well, right away, you know, in general, Jews are relieved because, I mean, again, the Americans are far away, you know, fighting in France, and making their way towards, but they're nowhere near Eastern Europe, and the Soviets are the only hope for survival. When the Red Army comes in, two members of the paper brigade, the poets, Shmerka and Sutskeva, they immediately return. They have survived. They return, and the only reason they're returning is to find the hidden, buried cultural treasures. Their families have been murdered. They're not the kind of people who want to come back to look for, I don't know, their apartment or property. They're going back to find the papers that they buried underneath the ghetto. And they quickly and luckily get permission to create a Jewish museum in Vilna. And that museum, they get a building, but within a year, and so the retrieval, there's a bigger retrieval operation, a lot of volunteers, people literally digging with their hands underground to find stuff. And it's all taken to this museum. But within a year, these poets and the heads of this museum realize the materials are in danger again. The Soviets are basically strangling this institution. There's hardly a budget. There's no glass in the windows. There's no vehicles. They can't really pay salaries. And then, to tip it all off, the authorities one night come. There was lots of material sort of piled up in a courtyard because the museum didn't have enough space and hadn't processed it yet. So there was material of the museum piled up in a courtyard. The garbage sanitation department, the garbage administration comes and takes it all away and sends it away as garbage. That's a real traumatic experience when they realize the Soviets will destroy this material just like the Nazis did. And then, I guess the last piece is when KGB agents come into the museum and say to the heads, you know, you can't show this material to anyone. It must first go through censorship. We don't show books or documents to anybody. They must be censored first. And when the museum heads ask, well, do you have any censors that will review the material? Do you have censors who can read Yiddish and Hebrew? The answer comes back, no, we have no such censors. And that's when they realize that the material is doomed if it stays in the Soviet Union.
So how do they react to this? I know that Shmerka eventually ends up fleeing. What do they do? Do they say, let's go to St. George's Church and put this at the bottom of everything? What goes on here in the next several years? And then how does this stuff just kind of vanish for the next several decades?
No, the stuff that eventually ends up in St. George's Church is the stuff that they couldn't take with them. But they, as much as they can, they fill up suitcases and arrange for the smuggling of material across the border to Poland, and then from Poland onward. And that material that they successfully smuggled a second time, right? First they smuggled it from the Nazis, and then they smuggled it out of the country from the Soviets. That material ended up either in New York, where we have it right here at the YIVO Institute, the same Yiddish Scientific Institute, and some of it was taken to Israel because some of these heroes ended up in Israel and gave it, for instance, the National Library of Israel. So that stuff was taken out in 45 and 46. But there was a limit to how many suitcases they could pack and smuggle. And this Jewish museum was closed down by the Soviets in 1949 as part of a general campaign against Jewish culture in the Soviet Union. So when it was closed down, its collections were scattered, but most of the material ended up in the hands of this Lithuanian book chamber. And that's where the story I told you earlier kicks in, of the director taking the material but actually hiding the material from his superiors for decades.
Which too is just an amazingly noble act. You're told to destroy these things. You're in the middle of a political situation that, you know, seemingly is unending censorship, and yet you take the time to and take the risk to hide all this material. Which again, reading through this book, it does give you tingles up your spine to think about the heroic nature of some of these individuals. What actually ends up happening to Shmerka and a few of the folks who made it through the paper brigade all the way through to the end?
The two poets, Shmerka, of course, is totally disillusioned with communism and the Soviet Union. He becomes a Zionist, but he can't get into Palestine for a variety of reasons. He ends up settling in Buenos Aires in Argentina. And then, quite tragically, 1954, he died in an airplane crash, and which was really very shocking to all the people who knew him, a very popular poet, thinking, you know, listen, he survived the Nazis. He got out of the Soviet Union, and then, you know, dies in an airplane crash over the Andes. So his life was cut short. The other poet, Abraham Sutskever, his good friend, did leave for Palestine and lived in Israel for decades and became probably the greatest Yiddish poet of the 20th century, and had a very fruitful literary career. But he always, you know, in the back of the mind of all of his poetry, the ghost of Vilna is still there. I mean, his childhood, his friendships, and then the traumas of having lost his mother and his infant baby boy to the Nazis, so that he remains this kind of monumental cultural figure in Israel.
Now, one of the things that your book does is not only tell this historical story, but you have a number of sidebars, or actually two or three pages in length, where you talk about some of the gems that have been found in this pile of documentation that has made it over to YIVO, and you haven't been able to go through the most recent find in great detail yet, but that first group of findings and documents, you pulled out some things that are what you call gems. Give us a sense of some of the things that are in there and what you consider to be worthy of just making a mention of in this book.
Well, for the earlier caches, you know, I can rattle them off. You know, a diary by Theodor Herzl, the father of modern Zionism, from the 1880s, handwritten. The record book of the synagogue of Vilna's greatest rabbi, the Gaon of Vilna. Right, this is a record book going back to the 1700s. And then they've got artwork, some of the work of, in other words, little statuettes, and bust, the bust of Tolstoy. And that's those are some of the gems that I describe in the book. But now in the new cache, in the new material, we found more gems. We haven't been able to go through everything yet, but maybe the most important thing I believe we found, besides that contract I mentioned to you, the water carriers and the academy, what we found is poems written by Shmerka and Sutskever in the ghetto. These are poets, and they're active poets in the ghetto. Now, they published some of this poetry later, based on their memories of what they wrote. But now we have the original manuscripts of their ghetto poetry, including poems that they never published. And I find that's a tremendous monument to the spirit, to the human spirit, to write poetry. And even beautiful poetry, painful but beautiful poetry, in a ghetto with death and starvation around you, is a real tribute to the human spirit. So that was very inspiring.
When you get a chance to sort through all this, and you actually pick up one of these pieces of papers, one of these diaries in your hand, is it? Very akin to a spiritual experience just to be holding that in your hand? I mean, we can look at it on the internet and read the poetry somebody transcribed onto a Word document or something of that nature, but just to hold it, it must be just amazing.
That's what I've said to folks. This material is not only important, in a sense it is holy. I'm holding because, you know, I know people gave their lives so that we could have this piece of paper. There's both heroism and martyrdom wrapped up in all of this. And so, yes, I mean, I'm an academic and a scholar, but I have to say that it is a spiritual experience.
Yeah, amazing. Let me finish off here with one last question. I'd love to always ask my guests this. You've obviously had a passion for this history for most of your life. And I think a lot of us older scholars now understand that research and our publications are not just outcomes, but they really represent a journey. And along this journey, we oftentimes learn things that may challenge our past beliefs about the human condition or surprise us in ways that we had never expected. And that's usually the most fun part of the jobs that we actually have. Let me ask you this. What things have you learned along the way of your own scholarly journeys? Perhaps something that the 20-year-old David Fishman might not have expected?
What have I come to understand? First of all, I've come to understand the fragility of not only of life, but of human cultures. In other words, everything we have is precious, and so much of what we have can be lost if not cared for. And I'm very mindful of this kind of chain of generations now, that if we have books or if we have other cultural treasures, it's only thanks to previous generations. And I'm not talking only about this specific Jewish Vilna material. All cultural treasures that we have, it's thanks to earlier generations that protected them and cared for them. And any object, you know, we of that kind, we have to keep that in mind, our debt to previous generations. And I guess the last thing I've learned is human beings are capable of terrible cruelty and evil, but human beings are capable of doing amazing moments of heroism. And even standard run-of-the-mill people can rise to the occasion and show great heroism. So that's my bottom line message I learned, which is each of us at the right moment is capable of doing something extraordinary, just as they did.
And what you've done in The Book Smugglers is also extraordinary, to preserve the story of this history, which is just, again, fantastic. We will link to it on our website. Encourage people to read this book, because it just reads very fluidly and just, again, as I mentioned, many tingles up my spine just thinking of the heroism that you describe in this book. My guest today has been David Fishman. David, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.